The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Venezuelan crisis seemed to have reached its apex, but now blood is flowing. What can the U.S. do? We will get perspective.
The Venezuelans are convincing them to abandon Maduro, but also ensuring
that... From Latin American expert Mary O'Grady. Last week's attacks...
...are very heavily armed, so it could get ugly. 30 million people...
...on Karen Pence showed that the left will do anything. And sure enough, now they've gone after her children's book. And the boys...
There's a real-life bunny rabbit that is the pet of Vice Mike Pence and his family. And
the MAGA caps, though innocent, got no relief from the left. We'll hear from Larry Elder. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Flaunting their entitlement and displaying toxic masculinity. Quote, it seems...
Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And let me invite you to join us now by video at HughHewitt.com. Over the past 10 days, the situation in Venezuela, already bad, has worsened. Which is saying a lot, since over the past two-plus years, the country has lost an estimated 3 million citizens across its borders. The 30 million that remain are facing shortages in even the most basic supplies, water, groceries, fuel. It's reported that many families are starving. The crisis has escalated as Juan Guaido, the opposition leader and president of the National Assembly, has challenged Maduro, the dictator's, legitimacy. And now the U.S. and a host of nations around the world have recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. I turned to a regular on my program, Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher of the House Armed Services Committee. Mary O'Grady, page of the Washington Post. Maduro has sent out his death squads. They are killing people in the slums of Caracas, and they're going to keep killing them. Is it time to move with a military intervention of the U.S., Brazil, and Colombia against the thug and his secret police?
Well, the first thing I'd say to you is that I think the administration is on the right track. I think their message has been clear, consistent, and forceful. And I think lost in the recent reporting is the fact that they appointed Elliot Abrams to manage the entire effort. I think this was the right choice. I think it was a masterstroke, and Elliot brings a wealth of experience. And so the challenge going forward is, as you suggest, to work through those regional governments. The good news is that we're not pushing against the sentiment of our allies in the region. Rather, we are harnessing it. We have Colombia, we have Brazil, we have the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, all pushing for tough sanctions. And in the case of Colombia and Brazil, they bring capable militaries to the fight. So I fear this debate is being framed, as it always is when we talk about managing crises abroad, as a choice between doing nothing and an all-out invasion, when the reality is that we have a lot of options in the middle, and we can work by, with, and through those regional partners to ensure that this thing doesn't go completely off the rails. And I think our military can play a unique role, not only in enabling the Colombians and the Brazilians, and hopefully eventually co-opting the Venezuelan military and convincing them to abandon Maduro, but also ensuring that Russia and other outside powers do not provide more support to Maduro. That is a constructive role we can play that strikes a balance between nothing, as the left is arguing, an all-out invasion on the other hand.
Now I'm arguing for all-out invasion. I'll tell you why. Because 35 people are dead who weren't dead last week. And I believe when a thug decides to go down this road, like Zimbabwe's Mugabe, they don't stop. They don't maintain a baseline of violence. They don't say, okay, 35 a week will do it. They increase it. And especially if there's another massive protest today, he's going to double down. He's a killer. And so if we delay... what we can do, and George H.W. Bush with Panama showed it can be done, we're condemning people to die that don't have to die, Representative Gallagher. And I mean, this isn't about another day without food or another day of marginal starvation or another day of refugee flows. All the stuff that might have acted prompted Colombia and Brazil to act eventually. It's about, body counts.
Well, I will concede to you this, Hugh. The vice president wrote and reinforced in his speech that Maduro must go. And indeed, they are rallying countries around the world to accept that position. You don't say something like that unless you are prepared to back it up. Now, I don't know if John Bolton's yellow pad, 5,000 troops, was deliberate or not. All I know is that John Bolton is a very smart man who doesn't do things casually. Perhaps it was intended to send a deliberate signal. If you look at what that means, that's a bit too large to be a Marine Expeditionary Unit, but 5,000 troops is roughly an Army Brigade combat team. That equates to a quick reaction force with some civil affairs capability, with very little armor or artillery. So basically that's policing capability, light policing capability, but probably enough to get the job done in cooperation with Brazil and Colombia and their forces. And historically, it's parallel to what we sent in terms of airborne troops into Panama during the Bush 41 administration.
Reports this morning, the brilliant editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal has written extensively on Latin American politics. O'Grady was a guest of my colleague, Dennis Prager. Go to town
already. The facts of what's happening in Venezuela.
Okay, well, last year, the dictator, Nicolas Maduro, had an election in which he barred the most competitive candidates from running, and so nobody showed up. It was basically a rigged exercise, and that was in May, but he didn't take office until about a week ago. And before he took office, something called the Lima Group, which is 14 countries in the Western Hemisphere, not including the U.S., said he should not take office because he is illegitimate. He was not elected, and instead he should follow the Constitution, which says that the president, the duly elected president of the National Assembly, should, in the case that, you know, there's no president, take the position as an interim president, and then there should be new elections. So they said that back, I think, in January 4th they said it. Then the dictator said that he was sworn in as president again for another six-year term on January 10th. And this guy, who's now the president of the National Assembly, said, no, I'm the president because I'm following the Constitution. We don't have an elected president, so I will be the interim president until there's a new election. Now, the problem with this is Venezuela is a military dictatorship. Repeat after me, all you friends of Cuba. This is a military dictatorship, as Cuba is a military dictatorship, something that the left in this country is supposedly opposed to, except when it comes to these crackpots in Latin America. So anyway, you have this military dictatorship, which means that the military is on the side of the dictator. And yesterday, which was the anniversary of the last time they finally kicked out a dictator, that was 1958, all these people poured into the streets, unarmed individuals, and not just in Caracas, although the photos of Caracas are quite impressive, but it's happening in places like the birthplace of Hugo Chavez, which used to be very hardcore Chavez land, and many other cities across the country. And the reason is simple. The country is starving to death. I mean, the living conditions are so squalid. I tell you, you would cry if you saw some of these pictures. Malnourished children, mothers who don't eat in order that the little bit of food they have can go to their children. Nothing like shampoo and soap and all those things we take for granted. No car parts, you know, so there's no transportation. There's joblessness. There's rampant crime. I mean, it is just a mess. And you have 30 million people who are saying, no mas, we cannot take this any longer. And all of this so-called support for Chavismo is gone. And all you have left is a bunch of thugs with guns who basically are in business with the organized crime racket that run drugs from Colombia through Venezuela. And on their backing them are the Russians, the Nicaraguans, the Cubans, the Iranians. Turkey is on the side of these guys, you know, small group of people. And then you have most of the international community, including pretty much all of Latin America, not Bolivia, not Nicaragua, and by the way, interestingly enough, not Mexico, but most of the rest of Latin America, all the democracies, the European Union, France, Japan, and the United States all saying, you know what, Venezuela needs to hold new elections, and they need to end this because there are 30 million people who are really suffering. And right now it's a standoff, and I can give you a little bit more about what's going on the ground there. It's very hard to know. It is really the fog of war has set in, and there's a lot of bad information being pumped out because there are a lot of bad guys who would like to see someone like me get caught in you know, promoting fake news. So I have to be extremely careful. But, you know, on the ground, I would say that there's this, you know, 30 million people who are against it, and you still have the military, most of which seems to be not turning on Maduro yet, but at the same time, they didn't fire on the crowd yesterday. So I think what we're going to end up seeing is kind of a low-grade war, maybe hand-to-hand combat in a lot of these rougher neighborhoods where, you know, the National Guard is basically going to be clashing with the real people. And the real people in this case, some of them are people who are very heavily armed. So it could get ugly.
You are distinguishing between the National Guard and the military?
Yeah, I am, because the National Guard is the one that's really benefited a lot from the drug trafficking. I mean, over the years, what has been pretty much ascertained is that the National Guard is the one that is that runs the drug trafficking business from Colombia through. You remember that when Venezuela badly wanted Honduras, because Honduras was the place where they would take the drugs from Venezuela and land in Honduras, and that's why they wanted Castro's friends in charge there. There's a lot of drug trafficking that goes through Honduras, and that's all run by the National Guard. Now, inside the military, you have, the best information I have, and I would not say that I can be assured of this 100%, but that, you know, Chavez purged the military, and he elevated all the loyalists to powerful positions. Mm-hmm. So it looks like you might have, you know, generals at the very top that are remaining loyal to Maduro. But my information is that among the rank and file, there's a lot of dissension and a lot of breaking ranks. But, you know, how that is going to manifest itself is still not clear to me. I think what I can say with a lot of confidence is that all of these guys in the rank and file, and if you look at them, they come from very, you know, lower income or middle class families. They have mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, aunts,
who are suffering,
who are all starving.
Yes, that's always right.
So they've had it with these guys, and they want Maduro to get out.
So theoretically, possible that the National Guard and members of the armed forces would clash.
Inside the armed forces, that there would be two different factions. And I just want to add one other thing, which, again, I'm not with this because part of it is speculation. I'm not on the ground there. I have some pretty good sources. But for sure, we know that Cuba, Russia, and Iran have an interest in Venezuela.
Please just give the bear.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of those discussions and sign up for the podcast. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
They have weaponized Marlon Brando.
Workers with children are very much in the crosshairs of the left. When the Town Hall Review with Q Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Last week, we covered Karen Pence's, quote, heinous decision to teach art part-time at a Christian school where she had worked before. Mrs. Pence was immediately excoriated across mainstream media. Her crime? Teaching at a school that is biblically orthodox on matters of human sexuality. Now, a week later, Mrs. Pence's intentions to work with the children is somehow controversial as well. My Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka, invited Margie Ross, publisher of Regnery Books, to help sort this out.
Can you explain to our listeners, Margie Ross, who is Marlon Brando, and what's his relevance to recent news in America?
What a great question. Well, Marlon Brando is America's favorite bunny rabbit. Marlon Brando is a real-life bunny rabbit that is the pet of Vice President Mike Pence and his family. And he is very adorable. I've met him. And so he is also the subject of a best-selling book that Regnery published with by Karen Pence and Charlotte Pence, the daughter of the Pences. Karen Pence is an award-winning watercolor painter, artist. Her original watercolors are the illustrations for this children's book called Marlon Bundo's Day in the Life of the Vice President.
Which is a massive bestseller.
Which is a big bestseller and an adorable children's book that simply tells kids, what does the vice president do? What's his job?
Right.
And so Marlon Bundo takes you on a little tour of a day in the life of the vice president. And as so often happens, the left will use anything as a political weapon. So they have weaponized Marlon Bundo. And their latest attack is on the second lady, Karen Pence, whom they have vilified because she is teaching art classes 2 days a week at a Christian school in Northern Virginia. That's it.
Wow.
Yep. So this
better call the FBI. Better call the FBI.
And the headlines ranged from, you know, all the normal talking points of the radical left, calling the school homophobic and anti-gay, and of course now that makes Karen Pence a hater, and it's just a sad but too typical example of the ugliness of the left, And so we decided we wanted to make a statement. And I'll tell you one other piece of the smear campaign is some quote nonprofit group decided that to make a point of insulting and criticizing Karen Pence, they were going to send a copy of John Oliver's famous smear book against Marlon Bundo, and so some group decided that they were going to send 100 copies of that book to Karen, the school where Karen Pence is teaching, which of course is just, you know, meant to insult and ridicule her, and frankly offend the values of the Christian school.
So we have this attack against the school where the second lady is teaching.
Yep.
And they've plagiarized this Marlon Bundo super book. So what's Regnery doing in response?
Well, what we are doing is twofold. First of all, we are sending 100 copies of the real Marlon Bundo book, the original, Marlon Bundo's Day in the Life of the Vice President by Karen and Charlotte Pence. We're sending 100 copies for free to Karen Pence's school to make sure that the students there have this wonderful, delightful book. And by the way, the book has no political axe to grind. All right, and the second thing we're doing is we thought, okay, well, why not figure out a way to make this book available to schools across the country, not just Karen Pence's school, but all over the country. So we've posted something new on our website, regnery.com, where anyone can go to our site and order a single copy for their school library or a whole box of books for a, you know, elementary school class and send it to their school in their community. And we are doing it at cost. We are making zero money. The Pences are making zero money. We are literally selling these books for the cost that we spent to print them and the cost to ship them, and that's it, because we think it's important that this book reach as many school kids as possible and help them understand one of the great things about this country, which is our system of government.
Do you remember the media's vicious attacks on some schoolboys wearing MAGA hats accused of harassing a Native American at the Washington Monument? Of course you do, although you wish you could stop hearing about it. Some of the media retracted their versions of the story, but no matter, because it has found its way now to Hollywood. My Salem colleague Larry Elder reflected on a couple of actresses' recent posts.
I want to say something about this actress, Melissa Milano, who wrote a long piece about why she believes the mega cap is a symbol of hate. She said the boys were flaunting their entitlement and displaying toxic masculinity. Quote, it seemed to me like they were reflecting the white nationalism and racism that the hats on their head have come to represent. So I won't apologize. We need to have a conversation about, quote, systemic racism. I wrote a column about one of them, Anne Hathaway. Remember that incident in Oakland where those black sisters were attacked by a white guy wielding a knife? He killed one sister. Turns out his family told authorities that he suffered from mental problems. But people didn't wait for that, nor did Anne Hathaway wait for that. She wrote, Nia Wilson's murder is unspeakable and must not be met with silence. She was a black woman and she was murdered in cold blood by a white man. White people, including me, including you, must take into the marrow of our privileged bones the truth that all black people fear for their lives daily in America and have done so for generations. We must ask our white selves, how decent are we really? Not in our intent, but in our actions, in our lack of action. You really think if you took a magic wand and waved it over America and removed every smidgen of racism in the hearts of whites, that our problems would be solved? Blacks are 13% of the population, but they commit 26.1% of hate crimes. Whites are roughly 75% of the population, 70%, and they commit a lower percentage of hate crimes compared to their population at 46.3%. Systemic racism? You look at interracial violent crimes. In the most recent year for which the data seems to have been collected, there are roughly 500,000 such interracial violent crimes. Blacks committed over 400,000 of them. Whites committed about 90,000 of them. In other words, blacks commit more than 80% of all the interracial black-white violent crime. Systemic racism? I think one of the last times I was on CNN, I mentioned to Don Lemon that CNN and Time had done a poll in 1997, a poll of black teens and white teens. And they were asked, is racism a major problem in America? And not too surprisingly, both sets said yes. Although, interestingly enough, more white teens said racism was a major problem in America than did black teens. And then the black teens were asked, is racism a small problem or no problem in your own daily life? 89% of black teens said in 1997 that racism was a small problem or no problem in their own daily lives.
Coming up,
the utilities may have a stake in the cause of these terrible wildfires that have hit California.
The cost of living in California may be heading up again when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, you'll hear a couple of key voices looking at the atrocious abortion bill in New York City. Paul Kenger of Grove City College.
A lot of this reminds me of, you know, ancient pagans celebrating something that is ultimately about the death of the unborn.
And my good friend Al Mohler of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary.
It is clear that he intends, especially in this third term in office as New York's governor, to make his mark as one of the most morally liberal, he might style it, politically progressive political leaders in American history.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, is the utility company that serves almost half of California, the nation's most populous state. PG&E serves Santa Rosa, the epicenter of the Tubbs Fire in 2017. It also serves the town of Paradise, where the Camp Fire wreaked devastation in 2018. Billions of dollars of property, as well as dozens of lives, were lost. PG&E, now facing staggering lawsuits for reparations in the billions, recently sought Chapter 11 protection in bankruptcy court. Pete Peterson, dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy and a sponsor of this show, has made it his business to watch closely the workings of California politics and public policy. I spoke with Pete on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to begin with the big story. It's the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Pacific Gas and Electric files for bankruptcy following the California wildfire seeking Section 11 protection. What do you make of that?
Well, Hugh, as you know, the fire season, especially this last one, which actually affected Pepperdine deeply with the Woolsey fire, but the Camp Fire and the Northern California fires, which are more engaged in this, particular filing for bankruptcy shows that the utilities may have a stake in the cause of these terrible wildfires that have hit California. Obviously, they're seeking to get out from under the lawsuits that have already been lodged against the utility itself, but obviously power has to be delivered. So I don't exactly know how we're going to find our way through this, but suffice it to say, it is reflective of a terrible wildfire season.
The 2017 Tubbs Fire burned 37,000 acres and killed 22 people. Many believe it was caused by a downed power line. But unless they limit liability, there won't be power producers. That's what the nuclear power industry needed back in the day when they were begun. They needed a guarantee against liability for leaks. Otherwise, no one would try one. Do you think that California's legislature is going to find any way to protect their power delivery systems, or is California going to go through that blackout phase again?
Well, I certainly hope so, Hugh. As you and I both know, trial attorneys have been big supporters of the Democratic Party here in the state, along with a lot of other people, frankly. At the same time, you're right. I mean, we do need power delivered. And if these utilities are not protected against these lawsuits, we do look at another season, if not an era, of brownouts and blackouts. So we need to find a way through to protect the utilities so they can offer this essential service. They are quasi-governmental entities and treated differently than many private sector companies, and in that, you need to find a way to provide them legal protection.
Now, I also have seen Senator Kamala Harris begin her presidential campaign. Have you been watching, by the way, how skilled she is at this?
Very good, Hugh. I mean, she really does. That event that she hosted to announce the campaign in Oakland was terrific media.
Yeah, and so we've watched her for years, people in California. How would you describe her to non-Californians as a political talent if they haven't experienced her yet?
Well, Hugh, I think back to her first run for statewide office, which was the attorney general's race in 2010. It's hard to believe it now, but she won by less than 2% of the statewide vote to Steve Cooley, who was the L.A. County attorney, the district attorney. Since then, she has really demonstrated some great political skills. She obviously comes across very congenial and supportive, at the same time strong, and running on this platform of defending the people, coming from this background as a state attorney general, I think is a demonstration of her skill in being both connecting at the same time being strong. So she is a formidable political figure.
Formidable political figure, and I also think someone who gets better as the race goes on. I've been watching her a long time. I think she has a skill set which is unique, and I'll tell you a story. I was in New York Central Park with Van Jones doing an event, I guess it would be 18 months ago, the summer of 18 months ago, after President Trump had been elected, and it was Central Park, so it was a very diverse audience, age and ethnicity, but it was pretty far to the left, and I was the punching bag for Van, but that's fine, I don't mind that. And at the end, the moderator says to me, so is there anything you want to say that you haven't said? I said, yeah, I just want to say that your party has an incandescent political talent in Kamala Harris, and there was a spontaneous standing ovation. Now, they wouldn't know Kamala if they walked into her on a subway, right? But
right.
They like the idea of her. What is that idea, Pete Peterson?
Well, again, I think it's the ability to connect both in a very personal way, but also have a sense of strength. You know, it's not often that either men or women possess that ability, especially as a political figure, to connect on a personal level, but also to be seen as someone who is strong. And I think that combination is really striking. And it goes to that point that you made, that description of incandescent, I think, is good. Now, on the policy side, you know, has problems with math, right? She's not very good in being able to add these things together. At the same time, though, as a political figure, again, she's very strong.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
he would be called upon to save London and save Britain and save the Empire.
Andrew Roberts on Sir Winston Churchill. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. It may be true that more than 1,000 books have been written on Winston Churchill, the statesman of the 20th century. Churchill is, of course, remembered for his heroic leadership, which saved Great Britain from annihilation in World War II. But how many know that Churchill was a hands-on soldier in 5 separate campaigns on 4 different continents? Distinguished British historian Andrew Roberts spent 4 years writing his masterpiece volume, aptly titled Churchill, Walking with Destiny. My friend Dennis Prager invited Roberts on his show to talk about it.
I don't know of a character in the 20th century and perhaps before that like him. He truly seems unique. Is that fair?
I think that is fair, yes, because so many areas of statesmanship that he touched, so many areas of life that he touched. You're quite right. It is difficult. Maybe Queen Elizabeth I. You'd have to go back really to the 17th century and 16th century to come across somebody in British history of the sheer sort of breadth as Winston Churchill.
His wit. The speed of his wit. There were times I laughed aloud. By the way, I actually read to my audience his comment on exercise. The exercise I get is pallbearer at the funerals of my friends who exercised.
I know. He was never happier than when, as a sort of meat-eating, cigar-smoking...
and then the images of him dictating a wartime correspondence in his bathtub with a cigar. Who is like that?
No. Yes, the eccentricity is extraordinary. You know?
And yet he had such a sober assessment of the world while being an eccentric.
That's right. He also had a statesman's view of the world and an incredibly careful summing up of the various sort of world powers and the interactions between them and everything else that you expect and require in a great statesman.
Do you know the single thing that struck me in your long and fascinating book was how often he cried?
Amazing, isn't it? I know you think of him as a buttoned-up Victorian aristocrat, but in fact he was a throwback, wasn't he, to an earlier era, a Regency era, where people wore their hearts on their sleeves much more than in the Victorian times.
Not only that, but you can't get more masculine than Winston Churchill, and the man cried regularly.
Yes, absolutely. He was not that stiff upper lip figure that one thinks of the Victorian.
And nobody thought less of him, apparently. You do not have any example of people go, oh, there's Winston crying again.
No, well, Edward and Mrs. Simpson called him Crybaby, but other than that, there's nobody who... and that's quite an affectionate thing, I think. They didn't mean that in an unpleasant way. But other than that, no, people did appreciate that he was just built on a different scale to a different kind of era than the rest of them, really.
And on a very serious note, he was annoyed with America for not helping Britain more or even ideally joining the battle against Hitler.
I think annoyed is a very
understated
word for what he felt. He gets, I think, intense frustration, which he couldn't, of course, publicly state. And you get that, don't you, in the King's diaries, where Churchill was able to tell the King how frustrated he was that the Roosevelt administration wasn't moving closer towards actual outright bellicosity against Hitler. And yet, part of the frustration was the very fact that, in public, of course, he had to keep that entirely buttoned up.
So, in the final analysis, he really became he came to love Franklin Roosevelt.
He did, although, of course, the relationship did break down by the fall of 1944, when the sort of long-term interests of the American Republic did diverge from the British Empire, and there are some 200 more letters or telegrams from Churchill than there are replies from FDR, and so there you see a sort of a cooling of relations by that stage of the war, sadly.
I just want to explain to my listeners, the walking with destiny is almost eerie. Please tell my listeners at what age he predicted he would save England.
Yes, he was 16. He was a schoolboy at Harrow. He said to his best friend that in his life he would see great troubles and terrible upheavals, and that he would be called upon to save London and save Britain and save the Empire. And he was literally 16 years old, exactly half a century before he had to do all of those things.
How do you explain that?
An extraordinary sense. I don't think it's possible to understand Winston Churchill without this sense of destiny. He believed that, in his words, there were invisible wings that were beating over him that saved him on any number of brushes with death throughout his life. Saved him for greater things, and in this case, saving London and Britain and the Empire.
Is that one of the reasons? Is it? I'll give you a sort of multiple choice. Is it A, one of the reasons? Is it B, the reason? Or C, no reason at all for why he was so physically courageous?
I think it's the most important reason. Am I allowed D as the answer to that?
Yes.
I think it's the most important reason. I think that his extraordinary physical courage came from a driving ambition, a knowledge that he never had enough money to buy a seat in Parliament, as you could do almost in those days. And so what he needed to do was to distinguish himself on the battlefield. On so many times, he fought in five campaigns on four continents, that the Parliament would just have to have him because he was such a distinguished soldier. And so and the reason he wanted to do that was because of this driving sense of personal destiny and an attempt to vindicate his father as well.
The rest of that interview is available at townhallreview.com, as are all of our podcasts. I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
She stood there, and in that moment of hearing upon the death of her husband and two children, said, "We are going to forgive them." And I think that was the greatest statement of who she was, why her and her husband were there serving, and actually the freedom so that she could then there and stay and serve the people.
The lead actor in The Least of These, when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The story of Graham Staines, an Australian medical missionary who went with his family to a remote village in India, is now coming to the big screen. In the late 90s, we were shocked to hear how Staines and two of his sons had been murdered by Hindu radicals. Staines' wife Gladys, brilliantly played in a new movie by actress Sherry Rigby, did not leave India. Pregnant at the time, Gladys chose to remain and serve those who murdered the three members of their family. Here's my Salem friend and colleague, Mike Gallagher.
The story of Graham Staines is a tough one to watch. It's a true story, grisly murder by religious extremists. Sherry, tell me a little bit about your process and your decision to accept a role like this and share with the world this true story.
Absolutely. Back in 2014, literally, I was sitting in front of my fireplace in California, and I was praying about what the next story was that the Lord was going to give me to tell. A few weeks after this particular time, I had received a call from Beverly Holloway, this amazing cast director out of Los Angeles, and she had this offer on the table for me. But the only thing is, you have to go to India to do it. And I said, "Great, no thank you." And I actually declined the role.
Nothing against India, and of course, a big right. part of the world's population lives there, but that's a tough gig.
It really was not a place on my bucket list, and so I declined the role, but after time with Victor Abraham, which is the executive producer on it, and him just sharing the story with me and then reading the script and really praying about it, what I realized that it really was an incredible story that needed to be told. And especially as we go into the culture that we're in right now, that you could take somebody like Graham and Gladys Staines and their children, that they could be accused of something that they really weren't doing, that really was not happening at this particular time in India right. with them. They were only there serving a culture of people, you know, the lepers that were living there, and yet they were martyred for that. I hope that we are refreshed and refined to see that we need to get back out there and really start serving again and being in and on the battlefield to make sure that we're serving the people of God.
I was amazed to learn that Gladys Staines, who you play and her and family, stayed in India for years after her husband and her son's grisly murder. So that was pretty profound, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. I think that it is profound, and I think that she is really, when you hear about their story, you realize there was a possibility of them giving up their lives, and they knew that going in. She stood there, and in that moment of hearing upon the death of her husband and two children, said, "We are going to forgive them." And I think that was the greatest statement of who she was, why her and her husband were there serving, and actually the freedom that in that moment of her saying, "I forgive them," that she found so that she could then there and stay and serve the people that took the life of her loved one.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, best podcast platform in America, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and of course, Dwayne the Garden Gnome Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thanks for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.